All right, let's briefly review where we ended up last week. We had covered the decline of the Hasmonean rulers. So the Hasmonean dynasty were the family of the Maccabees that went down through the subsequent generations after the Maccabean revolt. And we looked at sort of the end of those rulers, and we saw basically a period of decline among the Hasmonean rulers as we went from subsequent generations. And then that sort of culminated in the civil war between two of the descendants of the Hasmoneans, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II, if you have your family tree there, right in the middle. We talked about how those two sort of ended up vying for power and kind of led to a civil war. And two of the themes that we looked at in the subsequent generations, so now we're talking about the first generations of the Maccabees, Simon, Judas, and Jonathan, and then John Hyrcanus, and then his son, Janaeus Alexander, and then the two sons of after that, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. The corruption of the political office, we noticed how after the first generation of the Maccabees, their subsequent descendants really began to imitate the rulers of the Syrians and the secular rulers of the day, and really tried to be like them. And then, probably more importantly, we saw the corruption of the priesthood. So remember, these rulers were also the high priests at the time. So we saw the corruption of the priesthood, and that sort of culminated. We talked briefly about the Qumran community, how the folks that went out to Qumran, you know, in the area of the Dead Sea, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. In the Dead Sea Scroll writings, we have these references to the wicked priest. And there's a lot of debate about who the wicked priest is referring to. And we talked last time about how it's probably likely that some of these Hasmonean rulers were the ones that they had in mind by referring to the wicked priest. And most likely, I think, Janaeus Alexander. Remember, we talked about how the rabbinical literature speaks of the time when King Janaeus put the rabbis to death. And so that's sort of a testimony, I think, to the corruption that had happened in the high priesthood at this point in time. We see the way that the pious Jews who had removed themselves to Qumran viewed what was going on in Jerusalem at the time. And then we have this quote here from last week from F.F. Bruce. This is kind of referring to the way the different people responded to the Hasmoneans. And so Bruce says, the Hasidim, and remember those are the pious Jews, the Hasidim were not greatly enamored of the Hasmoneans' assumption of the high priesthood for themselves. The Pharisees tolerated the situation under protest. The community of Qumran found it so intolerable that they withdrew from association with a temple and administration defiled by a wicked or illegitimate priesthood. So you see there the different reactions of the different groups to what was going on in Jerusalem. The Pharisees tolerated the situation under protest. So the Pharisees were the ones, if you remember from last week, that were openly now opposing the Hasmonean ruler of the day. That started under John Hyrcanus and then really came to a head under Janaeus Alexander when he was actually ended up slaughtering some of the people because of the opposition to what he was doing. And so, just as a side note, we see here the rise of the parties in Judaism. So this period that we're looking at right here witnessed the beginnings and really the first historical references that we have in the literature to the parties like the Hasidim, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and in the Qumran community. The qualities of these parties and their differences are what we find when we open the pages of the New Testament and we see references to the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Zealots, things like that. The roots of all of those parties and their beliefs and differences are found here in this period. And so that's kind of where we ended up. That's a brief review of what we did last week. And at this point, we're going to turn to the new section, which I've entitled The Rise of Rome or the Roman Era. And this is really the last historical section. This is going to be the end of the history. This is the last section that will bring us, you know, really up to the New Testament period And then if you have your overall course outline, you'll see that that's the last reference to the history. And then the subsequent things we'll do are we'll look at the literature of the period. I think that's the next thing that's up on the list. I don't actually have my outline in front of me, but I think we'll be looking at the literature. And there was a lot of literature that was produced during this period, the Apocrypha, of course, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Septuagint. We'll look at some of those things in the coming weeks. Really what we'll do then is we'll take a step back and look at all the cultural and religious things that developed over this period that bring us up to the New Testament era. And we'll look a little bit at some of those things and how we find references to them in the New Testament. So that's kind of a brief outline of where we're headed for the rest of the time this year. I did do a time check last week, and we're not going to get done this year. So that last part that I just mentioned will probably happen in the fall. So you'll have a break to think about these things and do some reading maybe over the summer. Are there any questions or comments about the Hasmoneans before we go into the next section? Yes. I have several Bibles at home that have the Apocrypha in it. And really, I've just selected the one that, and I don't have it with me. I think it's the New English Version, I think. So it's just the one that I enjoy reading. I have another one that's very sort of archaic in the language, which is kind of hard to understand. I'm not really an authority on that. I really wouldn't know. When I'm working on it at lunch sometimes, I actually just read it online. You can get it all online too if you don't happen to have a copy. But yeah, if you want to read some of the apocryphal books, well, we've been going through 1st and 2nd Maccabees this whole time, and really we're done with that at this point. That ends. But some of the other books, you know, we'll be looking at. Ecclesiasticus is one that we'll be referring to. We'll kind of go through all of them just briefly and just say what they're about and things like that. So, yes, Dave. Right. Some other Protestant traditions still have it in the Bibles, sort of useful books. Forget the phrase that the confession uses about that, but we'll look at that next week or the next couple weeks. But one difference that you'll find in the way the Apocrypha is in the Bible, if it's more of a Protestant-type Bible, the Apocrypha will tend to be, and then the one I'm using, it's right in the middle, you know, so it'll be between the Old and the New Testaments. If you get maybe more of a Roman Catholic Bible, they'll be scattered throughout because some of the apocryphal books are like additions to the other canonical books. So it makes a difference. And actually, some of the books don't really make a lot of sense by themselves because they're supposed to be attached to some of the other biblical books. So that's just a note. If you're reading the Apocrypha, you'll see those kind of differences in the way it's handled. We'll get to that in a week or two, probably, Lord willing. Any other questions or comments? The question is, what would be the one reference if you want to do some reading? It is a good question, because I've kind of equally used so many different books. The thing I like about F.F. Bruce is he's a conservative scholar, and of course he's an expert on the period, and he's an expert on the canon of Scripture. And he's very easy to read. So I would probably agree with that pastor that F.F. Bruce, a New Testament introduction. He also has a lot of books on the canon, which might be a little too late for you to read that now since we're going to start that probably next week. But he has a book called The Books and the Parchments, which covers some of the literature. And then I'd like to, after we're done with this class, if we ever get done with this class, I'd like to teach on the canon of Scripture. And that, he's got an excellent book called The Canon of Scripture as well. But his New Testament history book is probably a good place to start. You think about New Testament history that it's going to be a New Testament book, but he actually uses a lot of the introductory material in that is leading up to the New Testament. And if you have a New Testament introduction, by the way, at home, often you'll find a chapter in that, like at the beginning, that sort of covers just before the New Testament era. So you might have an introductory chapter on the intertestamental period and a New Testament introduction, if you have one of those. Yeah, so that's probably F.F. Bruce is the best source. I really like D.S. Russell as well. He's more of a scholarly person who is not conservative like Bruce, but it's very good. And you can't go wrong by reading the original sources. So Josephus is actually very easy to read. It's kind of thick, but it's just like a lot of the old books, like Calvin's Institutes and other books. There's usually a very lengthy section title attached to every chapter and section and book that you can just read that and understand if that's what you want to read or not. And so you can easily find something that you're interested in. So Josephus is very easy to read, and we have at least two copies in the church library here if you want to check those out. And then, you know, you can read over the coming weeks if you have access to an Apocrypha, you could read some of those books too. Maybe next week I could give you a little more recommendations on which of those to read. This next, last historical section is we're really getting into the Roman era now. And we've kind of seen Rome coming on the scene in various conflicts that we've seen along the way here. But here's where really Rome begins to exert its authority in the area of Palestine. And so before we do that, let's take a look at some Roman beginnings, which I've titled this section. Our kids are in the class today, and you can correct me if I say anything wrong here. You probably know more about this than I do at this point. They've been studying it in school. I think one of you are reading a book about Caesar Augustus, aren't you? So we've got some experts here, if I make any mistakes. But Rome had been growing in power really since the 4th century BC. There's different dates that people give about the founding of Rome. It's really the beginning of the early 5th century, I think, is when Rome really became established. And over really hundreds of years, it grew into the power that we all think of when we think of Rome. And it began as a small conflict confined to Italy. But then, as it grew in power and the Republic was established, they began to expand and conquer other areas out from what we think of as Italy today. And the Western Mediterranean basin was basically conquered by around 146 BC. So you can see how that overlaps with the period that we've been studying here and what really we've been focusing on what's happening in Palestine. But if you know a little bit about Roman history, you know of the Punic Wars with Carthage, which is an area right on the top of North Africa. And there were three Punic Wars. The first one was in 264 BC. And then we have the famous defeat of Hannibal in 201 BC. That was the second Punic War. And then the final destruction of Carthage in 146 BC. And there's a lot of interesting history there. You know, you've heard the stories about, I forget which one of the Roman generals said that it would be unwise to completely destroy Carthage because then we wouldn't have an enemy to make us strong. So there's a lot of very interesting history in this period. If you remember the story of Hannibal with his march through the Alps with the elephants through the mountain pass, pretty remarkable history. At any rate, we saw the expansion of the Romans into Asia Minor. Remember the Seleucid ruler Antiochus III, he was one of the most powerful, probably the most powerful Seleucid ruler that we studied earlier. He was trying to expand westward towards Rome, and he met the Romans at Magnesia, which is in Asia Minor, and suffered a crushing defeat in 190 BC. He lost all of his war elephants and was forced to pay a huge indemnity to Rome, and was pushed back, basically back into Syria. And so we saw that event, and then you all remember the famous confrontation that Antiochus IV had with the Roman legate in Egypt when he was confronted and told to get out of Egypt, basically. And that was the catalyst for the great persecution in Jerusalem. So you see Rome expanding in Asia Minor area. They've already established power in Egypt. And then they expanded also the other direction into Spain. Significant power in Spain was established around 206 BC, and they finally subdued Spain entirely in 19 BC. So that's sort of the quick, you know, overview of how Rome expanded and came eastward towards Palestine. And so they expanded through Asia Minor into Syria. And one of the major wars there was in northern Asia Minor. The ruler of Pontus was a man by the name of Mithridates, and he was a strong ruler that ended up fighting with the Romans and was eventually defeated. And then that paved the way for the Romans to come into Syria. And the Roman general Pompeius Magnus, who we know more as Pompey, secured Damascus in 64 BC, and Syria was then added as a new Roman province. And so we'll see the way that Rome operated was after they defeated a country, they sometimes established that as a Roman province. Part of their strategy when they conquered someone was to give them some rights. And sometimes people were made Roman citizens. Sometimes they just came under the Roman economy and power and had a lot of benefits associated with being a Roman province. And that was sort of their strategy that ultimately led to the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, for such a long period of time. Because they had a fairly wise way of assimilating the different countries into their empire. But anyway, Syria was added as a new Roman province. And then just a note about Roman politics. You probably are familiar with the republic that they had. We think of it as a very good thing that they had a republic, and maybe that was fairly stable. I mean, that's kind of the view that I always had of it. But in reality, while they were expanding, the home country was racked by civil war after civil war after civil war, and that's sort of the history of Rome. So the republic government was subject to a lot of internal maneuvering and politics and ultimately civil wars. And then as you might expect, every time we have civil wars like this happening, the military leaders end up exercising a significant amount of political authority because they are the ones that command the control of the armies. And the armies tended to be loyal to their generals. And that's, you know, again, pretty much the history of the world is that way. At this period of time, we've got the republic in place in Rome. I did want to mention the Daniel references. It's been a long time since we looked at Daniel and his visions, but just wanted to remind you that the power of Rome that we're seeing exercised here was prophesied in Daniel, just like the Babylonian and the Persian and the Greek empires were. And so I have these two references there. In chapter 2, of course, we have the big statue. And if you remember, the legs of iron and the feet of iron mixed with clay is a reference to the power of Rome. And then in chapter 7, we have the visions of the beasts, which corresponds to the statue in chapter 2. If you remember, we had the chart that lined them all up. In the vision of the beast, we have the terrifying beast with the iron teeth, which was referring to the Roman Empire again. So this is the final stage of both of those visions of Daniel. And if you remember, then particularly in the vision of the statue, we have the rock that was not cut out by human hands that comes and crushes the feet of the statue, and the statue crumbles, and then the rock expanded into the whole earth, which, of course, is a picture of the kingdom of God coming on the scene during the Roman Empire period. So I just wanted to remind you about those references in Daniel. And you can go back and read those over for yourselves. So then that brings us to the conquest of Palestine. Yes, Carl. Right. Yeah, that's an excellent question. The question is, we've been talking about Hellenization in the Greek culture, and then now that Rome has taken over, what happened with that Greek influence? And the answer is that there were some differences in the way Rome approached things, and they certainly ruled differently. They had a different military style and arrangement, but the culture was very much adopted as Greek. I mean, there were differences between what we know later as like the Latin culture versus the Greek culture, but I think everyone, including the Romans, still saw a lot of advantages to the Greek culture, and the Greek language continued to be sort of the universal language of that area of the world in this period. So sort of a co-opting, using of that Greek culture that was there, with some differences that we begin to see, but probably not a significant difference in the way that the people that were in Palestine were operating. The Greek religion, of course, and this is a good example probably of the co-option, is the Greek pantheon, of course, was just taken over by the Romans, and all of the Greek gods had Roman equivalents. So they just took over basically the Greek gods and renamed them as Roman gods in most cases. I think Apollo is the same in both, but a lot of the same ones. So the religious syncretism would still be in place, I think, with a little different twist to it, but still, you know, you see the compelling of Hellenization in worship that we saw under Antiochus IV. And in Rome, it just sort of turns a little differently, but it's still worshiping the Roman gods and then a little bit of emperor worship mixed in there. And then, of course, we have the charge later in the New Testament that the Christians were the atheists because they didn't worship all the gods like we do. And so we'll see some of that. And that's, of course, what led to some of the persecutions in the Christian era. So in that sense, the Greek culture really survived. Any other questions or comments? Yeah. Right. So a follow-up question would be, how did the authorities allow rule within the local area? For instance, under the Seleucids or even the Ptolemies before that, there was a large degree of autonomy that was allowed within Judea, for instance, and the high priest became the one that was the de facto ruler. So what was that like under Rome? Again, a little different. This is probably one area where they differed, is they had a stronger united empire where I would say it was probably more well organized. And this is the idea of provinces. So they have provinces that are under a Roman ruler, somebody who reports to the emperor, basically, or in this case, the Senate. The emperors weren't in place here yet. So we'll see how that impacts Judea, I guess, going forward here. But there was still some autonomy required or allowed in terms of religious worship, but there was definitely more of a subjugation in reporting to Rome. They seem to manage things a little more hands-on, I would say, than the Seleucids or the Ptolemies did before that. So you were, in a real sense, had to answer to them. There is quite a bit of difference between the successive empires, if you look at the Babylonians, than the way the Persians, if you remember, the early Persians had a very wise way of ruling. They had provinces as well. You know, if we read in the book of Esther, how Judea was, I don't remember what the term for it was at the time, but it was a province that, you remember, the horses had to take the message throughout the empire at the time and to all of the provinces. And then it all kind of fell apart under Alexander because of the division of the sections and under the generals, and you didn't really have a centralized government. The closest thing you had was the Ptolemies were in power for a while, and then the Seleucids were in power, but it was a much smaller sphere of influence. There were a lot of other competing factions. And then this, when we come to Rome, it's really the first time we see sort of a ruling with an iron fist, if you will, the whole large empire under a distributed but centralized government, if that makes any sense. Yeah, so it is interesting to see the differences between the different people that were in power. Okay, let's take a look at the conquest of Palestine. So we already touched on this last week, but there was really a civil war going on in Palestine between the two Hasmonean brothers, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. Remember now, Pompey had already taken Syria. The Romans were really right at the doorstep of coming into Israel at the time. And this civil war was viewed as an area of unrest that probably needed to be dealt with politically by the Romans. And so here they come. And both of the parties, that is, the followers of Hyrcanus and the followers of Aristobulus, went and tried to petition the Romans. And, you know, because they're vying for the opportunity to be the ruler of that area, of Judea, for instance. And so they both went and petitioned the Romans, really trying to outbid each other. You know, I'm more qualified. No, I'm more qualified. And interestingly enough, Aristobulus, if you remember when we talked about that, Hyrcanus was the one who had been initially set up as the high priest, and he was the sort of non-ambitious one. His brother, Aristobulus, was the military leader, and he was very ambitious and probably a type A kind of personality. So both of them petitioned the Romans, and it was interesting that Aristobulus won the favor of Pompey. So he was viewed as the one that should probably be given charge. But he kind of blew it all because he went over the top too much. He was too ambitious, and he sort of had a violent attitude. And basically what happened is Pompey said to both of them, all right, I've heard your cases. I'm going to make my decision in a few days or a few weeks, and I want you to remain in this place until I make a decision. Well, Aristobulus basically disregarded his orders and went off on his own. And that really angered Pompey. So he had sort of been the one that was going to win, and he sort of blew it. And so Pompey immediately went after him. And I think Aristobulus probably later thought that he had been foolish and was in big trouble now because he had angered the Romans. And so he ended up surrendering himself to the Romans, but his followers did not. So they all retreated into Jerusalem, and Pompey besieged the city of Jerusalem. This is again now in 63 BC when the Romans came in and took over. So he was besieging the city of Jerusalem. Now, inside the city, it's a mixture. Some people support Hyrcanus, some people support Aristobulus. Well, the followers of Hyrcanus, of course, wanted to open the doors to the Romans, and they did. They opened the city gates, and the Romans came into Jerusalem. The followers of Aristobulus, on the other hand, fortified themselves in the Temple Mount. You remember we talked earlier about how that was really quite a fortress there on the Temple Mount. So they fortified themselves and basically held out in the Temple Mount. They held out for about 3 months. Pompey besieged the Temple Mount and stormed the fortress eventually in the temple area after a 3 month siege and slaughtered many Jews in the city. Josephus reports that some 12,000 Jews were massacred at this time. And he actually entered the temple. So Pompey himself went into the temple, which was viewed, of course, as a sacrilege for the religious Jews, for a Gentile to go into the temple. But interestingly, he didn't take anything. He just looked at it, and he left, and he ordered the next day that it be cleansed and that they reinstate the worship. So that was probably a politically motivated move to let them go ahead and continue to worship the way that they were used to. So this event, when the Romans intervened in the civil war between the two brothers, really marked the end of Jewish independence and the beginning of the subjugation to Rome, which is, of course, the situation we find in the New Testament. Judea was incorporated into the Roman province of Syria. So now Judea and Syria were a single Roman province. And Hyrcanus was allowed to continue as the high priest. He was also given some political authority. He was named the ethnarch of Judea and Perea. Perea is a little bit to the north of Judea. So what happened to Aristobulus? Well, he was taken as a prisoner to Rome, but that's not the end of that story. There were a number of, I don't know how this exactly worked, but they were taken to Rome, and he and some of his sons, and they continually seemed to be able to escape. I'm not quite sure how that happened, if they were given a lot of freedom. Remember when princes were taken to Rome, they actually had a pretty good lifestyle. It wasn't like they were put into a prison. They were recognized as princes and were allowed a lot of leeway. You know, then they had some means to make an escape that way. But we'll see them coming back a few times with further attempts to regain the foothold in Jerusalem. All of those were unsuccessful. So, but we'll see how that continued to be a little bit of a thorn in the side of the rulers in Judea. So that's how the Romans took over Jerusalem in 63 BC. And then I just have a little side note here on the emperors, what was happening back in Rome. Rome, of course, had been governed by the Senate until the time of Julius Caesar. Julius came on the scene in 49 BC. And if you know a little bit about your Roman history, you'll know there was a civil war between Pompey and the Senate on one side and Julius and his followers on the other. Julius ended up winning that civil war, and that resulted in Pompey's defeat. And subsequently, Pompey was murdered in Egypt as he fled to Egypt. You'll see it, the Egyptian theme in here over and over again as well, which is interesting. But Pompey fled to Egypt after his defeat, and he was murdered there, actually right when he got off the ship. Julius, of course, took the title of Caesar in 48 BC, purportedly to restore order to Rome. you remember how that all worked. And then if you know your history again, probably most of you know it, at least from Shakespeare, Julius Caesar was assassinated by Brutus and Cassius by the conspiracy in 44 BC, which was really an attempt to restore the Republic, to wipe out the dictator and get back to the good old days of the Republic. And that happened in 44 BC. Well, after Julius Caesar had been murdered or assassinated, a period of civil war ensued. Brutus and Cassius were two of the ones who were vying for power. And there was an alliance at this point that developed between Antony and Octavian. Now, Octavian had been named Julius's heir. I think he was his grandnephew. He was related to him a little bit distantly. But he had been named Julius's heir. And Octavian and Antony banded together and defeated their Senate rivals in 42 BC. So you can see here we're getting closer and closer to the time of the New Testament. We're now in 42 BC when Antony and Octavian are in charge. The arrangement that they had after they defeated Brutus was they agreed to sort of divide up their spheres of authority. Octavian remained the ruler of Rome, and Antony was really put in charge of the East. So Syria, in particular, would have been under Antony's jurisdiction. Well, you remember we talked before about the Parthians, which is the place even further east, sort of northeast of the Sea of Galilee, up in that area. They continued to be a thorn in the side. You remember they had earlier been a thorn in the side of the Seleucid ruler in Syria, and now we're still seeing them being a thorn in the side now of the Romans. And they came and conquered Jerusalem in 40 BC and set up Antigonus. Now, this is one of the sons of Aristobulus. So he had been sent to Rome, but he had escaped, fled to the Parthians, and now they came with him and invaded Jerusalem, took over Jerusalem, and set him up as king and high priest in place of Hyrcanus, who had been the high priest established by the Romans. So you can see here, this is a whole period of a strange mixture of political ambitions by neighboring countries, but they're using the Hasmonean dynasty as sort of the person that they're propping up, because they were the rightful hereditary line in the view of the Jews. They were the sons of the Maccabees, basically. So you see this interesting political maneuvering going on between real politicians and the sons of the Hasmoneans who were still around on the scenes. So one of the things that they were vying for here was the high priesthood. Antigonus, when he took over, now Hyrcanus is his uncle at this point, if you can keep any of that straight in your mind. They're all related pretty closely together. Well, he basically maimed his uncle's ears. And why would he maim his uncle's ears? Can anybody think of why he would do that? Well, remember, the high priesthood is in view here. And what did you need to be free of if you were going to serve as a high priest? Any imperfection. Okay, so he knew that, and he said, I'm going to make sure that when this comes around again, which it probably will, you're not going to be able to be high priest anymore. So he clipped his ears. The story is a little more gruesome than that. I won't tell you exactly how that happened. But he clipped his ears to ensure that he could not become high priest again. Interesting move. So Antigonus then took over rule. So this is 40 BC now, for about 3 years, 40 to 37, until he was ousted later by the Roman forces that came back with Herod the Great. And we're going to get to Herod in a minute, so I'll probably save the rest of that those details for Herod. And then anyways, back to the Roman emperors. The other emperor that is in view here is Augustus. And so following the defeat of Brutus and Cassius, that conspiracy alliance, and then in 42 BC, Octavian and Antony agreed to share the power, as I mentioned, ruling west and east, respectively. Well, that didn't last that long. Then there's another person that comes on the scene who you probably also know from world history, and that was Cleopatra. Now, Cleopatra was the ruler of Egypt at the time. She's sometimes called the last of the pharaohs. So Cleopatra and Antony met and began to get involved. And Cleopatra had her own ambitions, and you can again read the histories in Shakespeare to understand all of this. But eventually Antony and Octavian began to fight amongst themselves. So Octavian got the upper hand, and Octavian defeated Antony and Cleopatra at a famous naval battle at Actium in 31 BC. Antony and Cleopatra then fled to Egypt again, and probably know the stories about both of them committed suicide at different times in Egypt. And so that happened in 31 BC. So now 31 BC, Octavian has basically taken over as the ruler of the Roman Empire. He was awarded the title of Caesar Augustus in 27 BC and lifelong tribuneship in 23 BC, which basically established Augustus as the first Roman emperor. So Augustus is the first Roman emperor, and of course he's the one that we read of in Luke chapter 2 in the year that Caesar Augustus issued the decree to force Joseph and Mary to head back to Bethlehem. So Caesar Augustus is the one that's in power in the early days of the New Testament. That's sort of a very brief sketch of all of the political maneuvering that was going on at this time, the rise of Rome. And the next thing we'll do here is cover the rise of the Herods, which of course is something else that we're interested in from the New Testament. Before I go there, are there any questions about anything so far? Everything clear? Okay. Well, maybe we'll just get started here. It is a quarter after. Let me begin by just saying a few words about Antipater. You remember that last week we mentioned Antipater as this interesting character who came on the scene, and we can begin talking about him in a little bit here. So Antipater was an Idumean. Idumea was the area just south of Judea. If you can think of your Bible maps, it's really the southern part of Israel. And that was an area that's directly across from Edom, and so there was a strong Edomite influence across the Jordan and, you know, kind of around the bottom of the Dead Sea there into Idumea. And so Antipater was of Edomite descent from the area south of Judea. There's a little bit of debate on exactly where he came from. You can see some of that in Josephus. I don't know if I put those references in here, but Josephus discusses this a little bit. But what Antipater was really the consummate politician. He had the ability to consistently align himself with the right people who were going to be in power. So he was very astute that way in aligning himself with the right people who were going to be in power. And so when the civil war happened between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, he aligned himself with Hyrcanus and ended up aligning himself with Rome during that time. Pompey ended up siding on the side of Hyrcanus and establishing him as high priest. And right in the forefront there, when Hyrcanus was the high priest, was Antipater. They were sort of connected at the hip. Antipater was putting himself forward as sort of a trusted advisor to the lawful hereditary ruler, which was the Hasmonean Hyrcanus. So he had wisely positioned himself in that role and aligned himself with Rome. And then there were a number of regional conflicts that happened after the Civil War. Remember, all of these battles were going on within the empire at the time. That we had the battle with Julius Caesar and Pompey. That was the first thing that happened. And they had been loyal to Pompey, but then they switched over and became loyal to Julius Caesar. So there was a lot of maneuvering going on, and he continued to support and help the Romans in the regional conflicts after the Civil War. So he was basically staying in good favor with the Roman power. And I just mentioned, when Pompey was defeated by Caesar, remember, they had all been supporters of Pompey, and now Pompey has been defeated by Caesar, so what's going to happen to us? And you'll see this happen a couple times over and over. Well, he supported Julius in the defeat of Pompey in Egypt in 47 BC. So he was quick to recognize who was going to win and align himself with the winner, basically. The reason I'm laboring this point is we're going to see this in Herod his son Herod as well. Very much a consummate politician. Anyways, that's just a little bit of an introduction on Antipater. We'll pick up here next week and we'll be talking about Antipater, and really we'll spend most of the time talking about Herod the Great.